we made the decision, look, we couldn't farm anymore. We'd lost, we were totally financially, physically, and emotionally exhausted.
G'day, and welcome back to another week of the Humans of Agriculture podcast. I'm your host, Ollie Lalive, and as always, thank you so much for listening to us. We'd love to know where you are listening to us today. So send us a photo on Instagram, click us a message, whatever it might be. Love to see where you're taking us. As always, I'd like to acknowledge the Wadawurrung people, the traditional custodians on the lands that I meet, and I'd like to extend those respects to the traditional owners on the lands wherever you take our podcast. This week's topic and our focus for the month of February is around good health and well-being, and it can go in all different ways, but I've been chatting to this fella for a couple of years. Today's conversation talks about mental health, depression, and Warren ultimately losing his farm and the challenges that came with that. So I just want to put it up front. There are aspects in this conversation which may be triggering. If you need help, please reach out to Lifeline, TX. We've got those numbers in our show notes. But I think Warren's journey is a really interesting one, and on so many levels people can relate to. So let's just jump straight into it. Warren Davies is known as the Unbreakable Farmer. Born and bred in Melbourne, it was in 1982 when Warren's dad pursued a lifelong dream of becoming a farmer. After suffering from bullying through secondary school, it was the perfect move for Warren to start afresh and meet new people in his community. After a career in farm management, today Warren focuses on sharing his story to help others learn from his experiences and overcoming adversity. Warren, it's great to have you on the Humans of Ag podcast, mate.
Yeah, well, mate, this is quite an honour. I've been following your work for a long time. So, for you to reach out and get me on, I'm pretty chuffed about that. So thank you.
I think we've probably been communicating, God, it feels like a couple of years now. And so I'm excited because I feel like we really wanted to shift and, I guess, start to focus on some themes. And this episode is actually going to be the first one around good health and well-being. And I think for us, good health starts with people, but then it also goes through to animals, the environment, and various areas of ag. But I think, yeah, it's exciting, and I'm looking forward to hearing more of your story. But firstly, mate, how are you, and how have you been?
Yeah, no, mate, it's I'm pretty good. So it's been a little bit of a hectic couple of months. We spoke off air the other day about what I've been up to, and you know, when COVID hit, as a professional speaker, it was kind of something that come to a grinding halt pretty quick. So wasn't able to travel and do all that. So I was lucky enough to fall back on my agricultural skills, and not particularly in dairying, but I went back. There was a local tomato processor that was looking for workers. So went back and, yeah, been driving tractors for the last few years in amongst doing speaking gigs when I've been able to, when you know, restrictions haven't held that up or whatever. And, yeah, so it's been pretty hectic.
Tell me, is that your first foray into tomato farming?
Yeah, it is. I really can see some real parallels between dairy farming and any sort of crop, really, because, you know, basically you're looking after them and you're nurturing them and you're trying to get as much production out of them as you possibly can. It's also, it's really mixed cropping. So with tomatoes, they're only part of the crop because obviously every year you've got to rotate and you can't have tomatoes in the ground in the same spot every year. So, you know, we grow, we had 400 hectares of corn in last year and probably the same as of wheat as well, a couple hundred hectares of tomatoes. So it's busy. There's always something to do. So I quite enjoy it. But yeah, I've done posts about this before. Like without agriculture, the last 3 years would have been a complete disaster for me. And I would have had to have given up that dream of the Unbreakable Farmer and, you know, sharing my story and hopefully having impact in communities. But, being able to lean on agriculture again and use my skills in a little bit different way. But, they always say, well, I think it's 180 skills that a dairy farmer have got. I've always thought that I had plenty of skills, but I wasn't a master of any of them. But, being able to weld and fix stuff and have that logical mindset that, you know, you can work through that problem-solving mindset, I suppose, has been really good to lean back on, you know. So But yeah, look, still looking forward to getting back out on the road and following what my passion and my purpose is, and that's sharing my story.
Well, I'm excited to delve into it a little bit deeper. But tell me, you grew up actually in Melbourne, spent a fair chunk of your childhood. Had you been exposed to ag, or like, when did agriculture kind of come into your life, Warren?
Probably as a three-year-old, mate. Mum's uncle was a dairy farmer at Tregow up near Karain. And we used to spend a little bit of time up there. And you've got this photo where I'm sitting on the motorbike. I reckon that's where the seed was planted. And I always thought farming was about tractors, motorbikes and slug guns, mate. So it was
my first interactions too, I think.
That's what I always thought. And then we had friends that were down at Trafalgar in Gippsland, and obviously being a little bit closer to Melbourne, we used to spend a fair bit of time down there, and that's where I fell in love with, I suppose, with dairy farming. But once again, it was more around those, the motorbike riding and going around with the slug gun with a mate, or the son of the family that we used to visit, and he's a mate of mine, and we used to get up to all sorts of mischief. And I suppose growing up in a, outer eastern suburb of Melbourne, that freedom of being on the farm was always exciting. And you do, something that you couldn't do in Melbourne is ride around a motorbike, wherever you wanted to and all that sort of stuff. So that was probably where I was introduced to agriculture, or as to dairy farming in particular, which, wouldn't have thought as that, growing up in Melbourne as that kid, that's would be the career path that I ended up following.
And because as a secondary student in high school, you moved out, your old man had this dream of being a farmer. Do you think, or did he potentially have romanticized views similar to, I think, what you've touched on there, the motorbikes, chasing things around, just the wide open spaces and having fun? Because that was certainly, I guess, my initial attraction into ag as well. Was that your old man's, piece as well?
Yeah, I reckon it would. Like, he grew up in South Yarra in Melbourne, mate. He was, you can't get much more in the suburbs than that. And he was a butcher by trade. And I think it was that romantic dream that's what it was. And, the freedom. And, he did his trade at the South Melbourne market, and then worked at the Vic market as a butcher, had his own shops and that in Melbourne. So once he'd done his apprenticeship and then moved on, he always had his own businesses, and mum and dad were small business owners in Melbourne. We either had milk bars, butcher shops, had a post office for 5 years up in Cockatoo, up in the Dandenong. So we moved around a fair bit. And so they always had their own business. So I think he always, wanted that. And then, that romantic vision in his head of being a farmer as well as a small business owner was, something that he could couple together. But I can still remember the look on mum's face, particularly because we moved on Cup Day in 1982, in the middle of the drought. So Golden Valley had never experienced a drought at that stage like it was. And we'd moved from, nice brick veneer home in Ferntree Gully in Melbourne with the nice concrete driveway to this friggin' dust bowl of a joint into an old weatherboard house and all that sort of stuff. But for me, I was like a proverbial pig in it, mate, because I just thought, this is fantastic, moving to the country. It was like something that, I was going to be now a country boy, and we'll touch on that part of my story, leave all that stuff that was happening in Melbourne and move to the country. And, I was really looking forward to, reinventing myself, I suppose.
What was happening in Melbourne?
Look, because we moved around a fair bit as with mum and dad being small business owners, we always lived at the back of a milk bar, plenty of good stories of catching petty thieves stuck over trying to climb through the barred windows above the door, with alarms going off in the middle of the night and all that sort of stuff. We always grew up, and so every business that they had, we moved on, type of thing. And something that I've realised, and it was a realisation when I did a speaker course before I did become this speaker, and that's unpacking my story, I learned a lot about myself. And one of the things that was, there was two things that I never really had an attachment to a community, and I was always the new kid on the block, but I'd realised that I'd been struggling with my mental health for a long time. Even though I really didn't acknowledge it or did anything about it, I just accepted that that's how life was. But as this kid moving around, I was always that new kid on the block. And, you know, even at primary school, my first day in grade three was fairly traumatic. Like I realised when I unpacked my story that I struggled with it, anxiety and low self-esteem for a long time. And so in that, even that grade three day, I can remember the teacher dragged me up the front and, you know, I'm self-professed, I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed. When she asked me to do a math sum on the blackboard up the front, you know, straight off the bat, first lesson, you know, instead of introducing me, she goes, new kid, come up the front and do this. So it was kind of very daunting. And I can remember even then, and something that when I share this, like I'm still even sitting here now, like the hairs on the back of my neck are starting to bristle a little bit, because I had a major impact on me. The, you know, the kids laughing and I didn't fit in because they thought I was the dumb new kid. And as I progressed at that primary school, it was the longest I stayed anywhere. So grade three to grade six. By the time I got to grade six, I was, you know, I'd become a little bit of a leader at that school. I'd created a bit of a friendship group, you know, I was Blue House captain and the bell monitor and all those cool things that, you know, the cool kids do. Well, not really, the dorky kids do them things, but I thought they were cool.
Everyone wants
to know. So, you know, I'd climbed that tree and I'd established myself there, but in mum and dad's wisdom, when they sent me to secondary school, they sent me to a private boys' school, a Catholic boys' school in the same suburb, like Infantry Gully, where we were based. But out of the 180 kids I was at school with in grade six, boys and girls, I was the only one that went to that school. So once again, I was back to square one. I was at the bottom of the tree. You know, if you'd seen me in real life, I'm about 6'3". And I was that tall when I was in year seven, walked into the school with 1,000 boys that day. We all looked the same. We all had our blue blazers and our ties and our grey pants, but I was the new kid because they were all in their friendship groups that, you know, the St. Pat's and the St. John's and the, you know, St. Paul's kids that are all going to primary school together at certain schools. They were there in their groups and here I am walking by myself. And it really started that day. It was real, you know, I was the easy target, I suppose. Dorky big kid and new kid on the block. So no one knew me. So they headed, they targeted me and it was just like verbal bullying at the start. But by the end of it, you know, by the time I left that school, it was becoming quite physical. And it had a major effect on my well-being, like my self-esteem particularly, but my anxiety as well. But that underlying theme to my story is I didn't do anything about it. I didn't reach out, and you know, because I thought, you know, keep your mouth shut and just suck it up, basically. But it also had a major impact on my education. Year seven, I was a straight A student. I didn't mind school really, but by the time I left that school, I hated school and I was failing school. So to move to the country was fantastic. You know, I always share, like at that school, my way of fighting back at that school was to make the footy team because I'm an AFL nut. And to make that footy team would, you know, kind of lifted your profile or helped you climb that tree. And I tried and tried over those 3 years and never made that footy team, which is a real kick in the backside as well, because I just love my footy. But, you know, I was up against some stiff opposition because there was, you know, there's only 22 spots in that team and a fair few of those fellas went on to play AFL footy. And even one of the blokes still is a coach in the AFL system today. So, you know, I was pushing a fairly full wheelbarrow up a steep hill to try and make that team. But it was, for me, that was like another point, another failure point, I suppose. I was failing at school. So that was, you know, disappointing. So moving to the country was a way that I could, like when mum and dad said, well, this is what we're doing. My sister was devastated because she was a suburban socialite, where I was more of an introvert, which I still probably am, which is probably hard to believe considering that I'm, you know, public speaker, but I am an introvert. So, you know, she was devastated, but I thought this is great. I'm really gonna, you know, revel in this. And even if it's just milking the cows or doing, you know, riding around on my motorbike or whatever, getting a slug gun and, you know, doing what you do, what you did back in those days. Yeah, so it was something that I embraced. And you know, so when we did move, I was pretty happy. And but yeah, as I said, mum wasn't. It's a real, yeah, the house wasn't, you know, kind of that suburban house in Ferntree Gully, and it wasn't, and it was, as I said, it was in the middle of a drought, so it was pretty hot and dusty as well.
So what age were you when you guys moved out there?
So I was about 15. So I was at the end of year nine. It was about 8 weeks of the school year left when we moved. So I was failing great, you know. Yeah, when I say failing, like if I brought home an E on my report, I think mum and dad would have taken me to Macca's for a happy meal. Like I was really failing at school. I was doing a good job of not being good at school. And, you know, it wasn't as if I was playing up at school. I was just, I'd lost, you know, it had basically been beaten out of me that I, my love of school. But arriving in Kyabram at the high school that first day, yeah, that's my aim was to, you know, head down, bum up, and pass year nine. Because I still had, I'd harboured this dream, even though moving to the country. See, I grew up in like Ferntree Gully, Cockatoo, at the foot of the Dandenongs or in the Dandenongs. And my dream job was to be a park ranger.
Huh.
What I wanted to do. But obviously my education was spiralling out of control downwards, and that really wasn't going to be, or in my mind, you know, these days there's so many pathways to be able to move forward, even regardless. I didn't see those pathways. So, you know, struggling at school, still even once we got to Kyabram, but I had this dream of, you know, passing year nine, or, you know, thought I could do that. And then, you know, see where school took me from there. But yeah, it wasn't too long into the next year, even though I failed year nine. They put me up to year 10, but it wasn't too long to that year until the principal called mum and dad into the office and said, look, got to find something for this kid to do because school's not for him. And you know, everything was falling into place as in moving to the country. Like, you know, I started playing senior footy. You know, someone actually recognised I could play footy. That was, you know, great. And then I won a premiership not long after that. And, you know, great group of mates. I found a girlfriend, never had a girlfriend before in my life. All these things were fantastic. Were, you know, life was good, but school was still my sticking point. So, yeah, had to find a career, I suppose. And agriculture was where I headed because, not because it was easy, and I really hate saying, like, you know, I just left school and become a farmhand, because it just sounds like it really downplays agriculture, or a job on a farm, as if, you know, any old chick kicker can get a job on a farm. It's not, it's it was, I went into that because, you know, obviously let go of that dream of being a park ranger, so I wanted to be a farmer. I wanted to be good at what I did, and luckily enough I got a job with one of the best farmers in the district. So it was a win-win for me. And yeah, he promised to teach me everything I needed to know about farming when he put me on, and he certainly did that.
I'm curious about the impact of having others and that vote of kind of confidence of them in you to actually see what you're good at. Is it something which has played on you and continues today, that, like, I guess needing that external gratification from others?
It's not with the speaking stuff. It's not. I've kind of let go of that. It's been a really, people ask me this all the time, but it's been a real cathartic experience being a speaker. If I had had the mindset I've got now when I was playing footy, I would have played AFL footy. Yeah. Pat myself on the back there, but because I was always looking for, saying, oh, you've done well or whatever in school. So it was something, I think that was really coupled with my self-esteem. Like, it was always, you know, wanting to be told that I was doing a good job or whatever. And really it doesn't matter now. Like, I don't care. That's not the right words. I do care greatly. But, you know, I don't need someone to come up and tell me I'm doing a great job, or I don't need 1,000 likes on a Facebook post or something to say, well, that was worth, you know, that was value. Because I know definitely at the moment, like, regardless, if there's one person out there that reads that post or listens to me speak and can use any of that information, then I'm happy. And so I don't need any gratification now. But back then as a kid, it was something that I probably did crave, and I wasn't getting it. And, you know, and it was something then that probably manifested a little bit. And it took a lot of work, self-development work to get over that. Yeah, but once I become my own boss and stuff like that, it's not something I ever search for, because, you know, I kind of went on a different tangent to a lot of people, like particularly in our road, and I knew the eyes of the world were watching what I was doing compared to my neighbours, and I didn't care as long as I was happy with what I was doing and I was ticking the targets that I'd set myself, then I was happy. And that's rolled on now into the speaking as well.
On the piece of working for yourself, so you had achieved getting and owning your own farm about the age of 22, I think it was. And tell me on that, was it everything that you were, like, so many people have this dream of owning their own farm. Like, was it everything you aspired to? What was the moment like? Was it euphoric when you actually achieved that?
It was, but I was probably fairly naive as well, because, you know, being a non-generational farmer, I looked at all my mates at that stage. A lot of them were generational farmers, and, you know, you just left school and you went back on the farm and life looked good. You know, they'll buy new tractors and they were doing a bit of contracting and all that sort of stuff. And it all looked rosy. And once our pathway into farming, like, I got to a stage where naively, as that 22-year-old, I thought my boss had taught me everything I needed to know. So I started searching for what was my pathway, and I looked at share farming. And, you know, our friends in Gippsland had some fairly negative experiences with share farming. So it was something that I really didn't want to go down. I looked at leasing. There wasn't too much to lease, but opportunistically, a couple hundred acres had come up for sale next door to mum and dad's that was just perfectly positioned to be able to put a bridge over an irrigation channel and turn it into a farm, you know, into a family business. And so I was a little bit apprehensive about that, because I really wanted to do it by myself, but, you know, that was a way in. And I thought I had all the skills I needed, and I always, any of the farms I've managed since, I always tell anyone that was worked under me, which I hate that word too, but, you know, worked as a, like, in part of my team, I've always told them, if they're not learning something today, check your pulse, because you're probably not breathing, because it's something that you're always learning. So at 22, thinking you know everything, so, you know, on one hand it was, well, you know, I'm free, basically, very naively, I'm free. But, you know, I went into business with mum and dad, and that was, you know, anyone that's listening that's in a family business know that that can be fraught with danger. Went into business with the bank because they lent me money, and then went into business with my silent business partner, who's Mother Nature, and I didn't really give her enough respect. And so she taught me a few lessons along the way, fairly savage lessons and some lessons that affected the rest of my life. So going into that business, it was great. And look, it was. But going into it, you know, we had to do the hard yards. So, you know, we weren't milking enough cows to support two families. So I used to do off-farm work in the summertime. I used to cart hay and do all that sort of stuff, or work at the cannery and do night shift and do some crazy, you know, stuff like that, like work a night shift and then work most of the day on the farm, and then, you know, just to make my dream happen. And I think that's, you know, that's how it becomes so all-consuming. You know, to be able to establish yourself in agriculture, and it's even harder these days, you really got to bust your ass to get there. And you do some stupid things, and we still do some stuff. Like, I've got a couple of kids that live in Melbourne, and we still do stuff just to fit things in. Like, we'll knock off at 5 o'clock or whatever and drive to Melbourne just to go and see the kids and be home by 2 o'clock to be at work again next morning. Like, but that's what we did as farmers, so we could have the best of all worlds but still be, you know, pursuing this dream of farm ownership and building a business that we could be proud of, and, you know, with the long-sighted dream of, you know, maybe having a manager on and being able to branch out into other stuff as well.
I'm really interested. I've never heard anyone talk about the silent business partner of Mother Nature. That's super interesting. I want to jump into that, because for you, that decline, as you talk about, as a 22-year-old thinking you've got it sorted, this is your thing, and then obviously working incredibly hard as well just to actually keep things afloat. When did you start to notice that things were starting to fray? And I guess, can you talk us through a little bit of like, what was that like? What was the first things that you started to notice as part of that?
Yeah, well, as I said, moving to the country was a great thing. So all those things, you know, leaving school, getting a job, you know, playing footy, girlfriend, all that sort of stuff were all positive things. So all that stuff that happened as a kid, I'd kind of swept under the carpet a little bit. And that's, I always reiterate that, that's the underlying theme of my story. And that's hopefully what people, one of the points that people get out of it is, and I did nothing about it. So it was all pushed to the background. It wasn't until like, so we, you know, we started to build our herd. You know, I was lucky enough that that boss, like it was pre-superannuation time. So that boss that I worked for 6 years said to me, you know, when he thought that, you know, I might leave, he said, look, we're going to rear 100 heifers this year. We'll lease a block. You've got to look after the block, do all the work. But at the end of the day, 35 of those heifers are going to be yours. And that was, you know, fantastic. So when I left that job on that farm and bought our farm, I had 35 Frisian heifers, which, you know, was a good start. Mum and Dad only had a small herd, but so we only had those small herds. So as I said, building up numbers. So we were building up the numbers, and, you know, a couple of years into this business venture with Mum and Dad, things were going really well. And come as October the 4th, I know the date exactly, and we ended up getting flooded. It was not a whole of our area kind of flood. It was similar to the floods that we've had this year, and we got impacted by that similar scenario. Rivers were full, got a, you know, 5 inches of rain, and all of a sudden we were flooded. But it was just our farm. Our neighbours were pretty well untouched, you know, wet but untouched, but we were fence line underwater. And I always say that's what I call what triggered my, what I now call my mental health journey. It was, you know, the stress of that event, all that stuff that I repressed or, you know, put into a box and said that's, you know, childhood stuff, all of a sudden was in my face. And it started like a little, the best way to describe it, it's like, was like a cloud above my head. But the thing is that the word, and I say this as well in some of my talks, and I've been pulled up by psychologists in the audience once, but failure is something that's dogged me, like, so failing at school, failing, you know, that growing up stuff. I didn't want to fail as a farmer. So my focus was all about recovering from that flood event and moving a business forward, and paid little attention to that cloud that had developed above my head. And, you know, so just focused on the business side of it and not the personal side, and just kept going. And that was okay. We recovered from the flood event. Everything got back to normal. Business kept growing. You know, herd started growing, you know, number-wise and that. And, you know, we're starting to get into a really good spot. But as I said before, you know, I always knew the eyes of the neighbourhood were on me because I kind of pushed the envelope a little bit in the way, you know, I didn't have a huge farm. I had, you know, a few years to catch up on all my, you know, my mates have had three generations behind them, and here I am trying to start. So I was trying to quicken the process a little bit, which was right or wrong, but I always loved the idea of being able to get, you know, maximum production out of what you were doing. So that's what I did. I pushed the envelope. So that idea kind of didn't sit well with Mum and Dad. And their vision was, you know, more of that lifestyle thing. But we were now moving into that era of dairy farming where lifestyle really, it's there, but it's not there. And it's more a bit business. And so, and that they were kind of struggling with that. And then that started a relationship breakdown with Mum and Dad, and which just kept deteriorating because my vision of the farm theirs went, we were going in two different directions. Come to a head, and it was starting to get fairly ugly, and it was having a major effect on me because family is my number one value. And once my family, well, particularly with Mum and Dad, and I've only got one sister and sister, so that all started to fall apart. I had to do something about it, but to try and resolve that. But it was having this effect, and that cloud then started to turn to a spiral, more of a, you know, a downward spiral instead of just a cloud. But once again, I was in that mode of, I had to recover from, you know, this family bust up. How do I do that? And I ended up buying mum and dad out of the farm, or my wife and I did, which was not where I wanted to be. Like, I didn't want it to be like that. My then vision was, you know, I'd buy the neighbours out. You know, we'd build a rotary dairy. We'll just get bigger and bigger. Not, I'd have to buy them out, which put a lot of stress on us financially, because, you know, we had to buy them out. We really wasn't at that stage in our business. There was no succession planning. So it's very interesting now when I do speaking gigs. A lot of the time, especially like in rural farming communities, there'll be a succession planning speaker coupled with me. So we didn't really have a succession plan. So we had to work out how we're going to do that. One, I wanted to resolve this issue, so buying them out would get them off the farm. So I did that. We took on a lot of debt, but we're on our own, so we were calling the shots. So I sat down with all our advisors and worked out a 10-year plan of where I was going to go. We this is how we can pay off debt, you know, get a new dairy, you know, maybe buy some extra land and all that sort of stuff. And the plan was pretty robust, but about 2 years into that 10-year plan, my mental health was still declining, you know, and not that I realised it, because I was so focused on achieving these goals. And then 2 years into that 10-year plan, you know, Mother Nature came along again and she sent the drought. And that was a real, you know, something that you can plan for, but you just... You don't know when it's going to end, so you don't know how robust that plan's going to be. And ours was, like, the first year, everything was good. Being in irrigation farmers, we still had water and all that sort of stuff. Feed was still cheap, but moving into the second year, water was a lot tighter and feed was getting dearer. And obviously I hadn't rained for a long time, so it was getting pretty dry and, you know, stressful. Moving into the third year, getting really tough. Like, we only had 15% of our water right, I think, at that stage. And, you know, hay was hard to get. And one of the things, that word failure started to sneak in. And in that time, the whole stress of the drought was really having an impact on my mental health. And also, you know, my vision of being a farmer was, I'm meant to be a steward to my animals and a steward to my land. And if I could do those two things really well, then I could look after my family. And moving into that third year of the drought, that was really having a major impact on all of that, because I couldn't do my job properly. And that word failure started to creep in. And then I started to feel a lot of shame and guilt, because here I had basically kicked mum and dad off the farm. And here I am, I'm only 2 years into it and I'm failing. And I didn't really look at Mother Nature as the cause of this. It was more me, and I was pretty hard on myself. My internal talk and my self-talk, and that was pretty brutal on myself, because I thought I was failing it. And really now in hindsight, there's nothing I could do. But I just kept working harder and harder, trying to beat that. And eventually got to a stage where I was in really dark places, like, and my mental health had declined that much. And, you know, and I was really... losing grip of our farm. I could feel it slipping through my fingers, and it was having a big impact on me.
Tell me about actually them walking away.
So that was, yeah, real tough time. And just before we ended up making that decision of leaving, you know, I'd hit rock bottom. My mental health was totally out of control. Wasn't seeking enough help about it. And, you know, with drought, it kind of really isolated me. So I was, I suppose, doubly isolated, because my mental health had really declined that much, where I'd stopped going to family events and stopped doing all the things in the community that I loved doing. Like, I was on kinder committees and school councils and, Auskick coordinator at the footy club and all that sort of stuff, and stopped doing that because I declined that much. My well-being had declined and my mental health had declined that much where I didn't think I was ever any value. So, just isolated myself on the farm, which wasn't a good place to be at that stage because, the drought was really taking a toll on our animals and the farm in general. So hitting that rock bottom really wasn't the catalyst to leaving the farm, but when I got to that darkest of darkest places, I just, life gave me two choices. I either could continue in this spiral out of control and, be bitter and twisted at the world for what it had thrown at me, or I could try and get better. And I set on that plan and, still, as I said, only a few years into our 10-year plan, still new and was confident in my skills. It's really weird because I was that depressed and in that low. My mindset was in such a low place, but I still had confidence in my own skills. It's a real weird thing conflicting thing to be. But so life had given me, those two choices. But about 2 months after this, the lowest of low, we made a decision. Look, we couldn't farm anymore. We were totally financially, physically, and emotionally exhausted. And we had four young kids. And we just found out that we had a fifth one coming. So, had to, make decisions, family decisions, I suppose, to try and see where we could end up. And I've been offered a job managing a farm down in South Australia. And a bit like when we went onto the farm, that was pretty romantic because something that I aspired to is having a big herd. So here I could go and manage this herd and have every second weekend off. Like, I think this is fantastic. Like, this is really the dream job.
Get the cake and eat it.
That's it. So we packed up and we moved and walked off the farm. But I never realised the impact that would have. And it was symbolically as the furniture van drove over the bridge and I shut the front gate on the farm because we couldn't sell the farm at that stage. We'd sold our cows. I symbolically unclipped my identity off myself and hooked it on the front gate. Because that's who I believed I was. I was Warren the farmer, and now I'd failed at that. And, I was in a pretty shitty spot, even though we'd made all these decisions. And in hindsight, we probably should have stayed, hung on, and, maybe just shut the farm down and restarted it years down the track. But we were getting advice, and we went with the best decision that we thought was right at the time.
On that, so you're getting advice on the farming side. Had you sought that from your personal side at that stage?
I had gone and sought, like, as in business wise, I was getting all the advice that I needed.
Yeah.
Accountants, solicitors and all that. But on the personal side, I actually had gone to see the doctor. And I always say I was tarred with the brush twice. I'm a bloke and I'm a farmer. So when I went and got that, sought that help, really didn't treat it seriously enough because I was still hell-bent on keeping things day-to-day going. So, when I went to the doctors, I typically tried to fit it into the schedule of the day. It was a 1 o'clock appointment or whatever. Went there, doctor put me on a mental health plan, which is all very confronting. But I just went with it because, I promised myself that I was going to get better. And the doctor then said, like, on the mental health plan, you're going to go and see a psychologist and here's some antidepressants. Well, I got home about 3 o'clock. Well, it was milking time. So the antidepressants went on the fridge. I went and milked and come home, had tea, went to bed, got up the next morning. And, a couple of weeks later, those antidepressants were still sitting on the fridge and I'd never touched them. Because, I was still able to do what I was doing. I was, I always explain, it's like being a high-functioning alcoholic. I could still function on that high level and manage my farm, but at the same time, the rest of me was falling apart. So I didn't really treat it seriously enough and had a bad experience the first off when I went to see this psychologist because they summed up. They said, look, we know what's your problem. And I thought, bloody hell, that's fairly good, 10-minute conversation and you know what's wrong with me. And they go, it's financial stress. And I thought, that didn't take a university degree to work that out. I'm in the middle of a drought. So it wasn't a really good experience. And it actually took me six goes at trying to find a psychologist that had actually helped me navigate my journey. Because that first one, like then she sent me, and this is no disrespect to the Salvos, sent me to the Salvos to try and help me with all the financial difficulties. And they gave me two vouchers, which total value was $500. Well, the day before I went for that appointment, I just got a load of grain. It cost me $15,500. So $500 worth of vouchers wasn't really going to alleviate my financial stress either. So it was a combination of things. Don't get me wrong. Financial stress was part of it. But I got to myself to that stage. So really didn't treat it seriously enough. That's one of the things I share now. Like, I'm always pretty honest and say, like, most of the stuff I talk about is all the stuff that I did terribly badly. But hopefully someone can learn from the lessons that I really don't want anyone to get to that darkest place and be so isolated and so scared and frightened and all those things that come with being at that lowest of lows. I really, strive and hope that, anyone that takes anything, resonates with any part of my story can take things away so they go and seek help, because it's really important that we do, and really important that we talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm interested in your opinion. I guess you talk about it so much and you have different experiences with different people, but as I think you mentioned before, in terms of you were tarred with the brush twice, you're a bloke and you're a farmer, so in terms of actually seeking help and whatnot, you feel like, I guess, psychologically already disadvantaged. But in terms of the epidemic that is mental health in rural Australia, particularly with blokes, how do we, like, in your opinion, how do we shift the challenge that is mental health and ill health as part of that?
I think it's just trying to normalize the conversation is one thing, but probably education's another thing, and also educating the community. And I don't pigeonhole myself just particularly as a men's mental health speaker. I'm more about community, community well-being and resilience and all that sort of stuff as well. But as a bloke, and I get to talk to lots of these fellas around the country, I think blokes do talk, and I think it's about, my mission that I'm on is about creating awareness and education around mental health and well-being, inspiring conversations, and empowering people to seek help in a safe environment free from stigma. That's my mission. So I think part of that education piece is about educating people about the subtle things to pick up on, because blokes do talk in their own way. They, if they're struggling, and that might come out whether it's anger or frustration or, drink too much or whatever it is. And they're all alarm bells for the people around them to say, well, or even a simple thing like at a footy club where, one of the blokes always is on time and then turns up late all the time or doesn't turn up at all. Like, they're all alarm bells that, even though they might be nothing and they've just had a bad day and, things have gone wrong and they haven't got to where they need to be, but they're all things that we need to be aware of. And if it happens more than once, then you go, well, maybe I should have a conversation with that guy and have the courage to be able to have that conversation. I think that comes from that education and awareness piece. So creating that awareness, even though there's lots of awareness and all that, I think that's the important message to take from the awareness part is, it's to educate yourself so you know what to look for and then have the confidence enough then to have a conversation with someone who you think might be struggling. But for blokes that are struggling themselves, just to know that, I think by sharing my story, when I say inspiring conversations, I hope by sharing my story that empowers other people to share theirs. And I know myself from personal experience that the conversations I have with blokes, after a presentation or a talk or a community event or, online or on the phone, weeks after, I know that it does empower people then to share their own story. And, I had a perfect example where, and I thought we talked about some of my upcoming speaking gigs. One of the conferences that I'm speaking at in March, I spoke at in 2019. And I was a plenary speaker at that conference, and I And the funny part about it is the Batuta Advocate boys were on after me. So you can imagine the crowd of 800 who just go, I wish this bloke could get off the stage. We want them fellas on stage. Like, and I always say to people when I get up on stage, look, some of the stuff I'm talking about, I'm not going to dance around it. It's warts and all. And if you feel uncomfortable, feel free to leave the room. If you don't want to leave the room, if you want to leave the room, you know, and you're struggling, you know, give me a thumbs down. But if you're just going outside to grab a coffee or whatever, give me a thumbs up. So I just know. And if you give me a thumbs down, I'll make sure someone supports you. Well, as a plenary speaker, I had 35 minutes, but the MC forgot to say 10 minutes to go and just went 5. And I've gone off on some bloody tangent talking. So I started to panic. So I wanted to get my messages out. Got off the stage and I thought, biggest opportunity I've ever had. There's 800 people in the room and I've just blown it. Walked to the back of the room, bit sulky, and stood there. Next minute, a girl came up in front of me and she had tears in her eyes and she goes, I want to know. I've got a boyfriend in Central Queensland. We've just broken up and he's got guns. What do I do? So I just said, look, I'd be, you know, can you still talk to him? She said, yes. I said, well, just talk to him and make sure he's okay and, you know, make sure people are around him or aware, you know, just went through all that stuff. And then the next bloke behind was, he was about 6'6", middle 70s, this guy, and he was a cotton grower. And he came up to me and he called me all the names under the sun, starting with the F and the C and everything. And I'm going, bloody hell, I've really stuffed this up. And he goes, no, your talk was good. He goes, but how the hell was I meant to stand up in front of 800 people and give you a thumbs down and walk out of the room? Because I'm the best bloody cotton grower in my district. And if I did that, everyone would think I'm a weak bastard. And I said to him, I said, well, look, mate, I think you've missed the whole, you know, whole idea of my talk. He said, that's okay to be like that. And anyway, I noticed that he'd been sitting with a couple of blokes and I said to him, who are those blokes? He goes, they're me. You know, we've grown up together. They're my best mates and my neighbours. I said, do they know what you told me? And he said, no. And I said, well, go and grab a beer and go and tell them what you've just told me. Well, they come to me about half an hour later and said, we had no idea that he'd been struggling for 20 years. Ironically, one of the neighbours, one of his best mates, had also been struggling for the same amount of time, but they'd never talked about it. And that's one of the things I talk about. One of the powerful things about community, or the most powerful thing about community, is shared wisdom. I wish I had met George when I was a young bloke and he had shared his story with me, because it might have been able to, there would have been something in his story that would have helped me navigate my journey. So that's where I think it's really important, that sharing stories and the power of storytelling, particularly around mental health and particularly with blokes. Like, you know, blokes won't turn up to an event where they know there's a mental health speaker. He's just going to stand up the front and go like this. So I try and make it a little bit more conversational. I love getting to events before I need to be there. So I get to meet a few of the people and you get a feel for what's going on. But it's about breaking down those barriers just so blokes will talk. But having said that, blokes do talk, but it's also educating ourselves around all. What are the signs that they're giving us so we can pick up on them a bit more? And I say that sounding like I know what I'm talking about. But the thing is one of the hardest lessons, the hardest realities that I've learned working in the mental health space, mental illness, suicide space, is that you can't help everyone. And that's really confronting. Some people can't be helped. And that's really a confronting thing. Like when you want to try and help everybody, everyone can't be helped. And that's a really confronting thing to be able to kind of process, because all you want to do is help people. And some people, you know, the suicide rate still tells us that there's so much work to do. And even though some of those people might come to an event like mine or a speaking engagement like mine, it still might not help them. And that's really challenging. So, you know, that conversation piece and that awareness and education is really important to try and work out how do we be more vigilant and more pick up the signs a lot more easier, and how do we pick up those subtle things in conversation, particularly blokes are having in rural communities. How do we pick up on those things, and how do we yeah, so we can try and make inroads on the suicide rate, particularly in rural communities.
Yeah, no, I think there's so much to unpack kind of in what you've said, but I think that, like, whether it's the little things of noticing of when people are turning up to footy training, when are they reaching out or calling, et cetera, if those things start to dissipate, like, I guess that starts within your friendship group. One question I ask everyone who comes on the podcast, which I'm keen to ask you, and I think you probably talk to lots of adults, but I think you do also do a few different school speaking gigs. Yeah. I think what I'd love to know is if you got the chance to go and talk to year 10 students about why agriculture could be a career that they should consider, what would you say to them?
Oh, it's just the diversity of it. Like, and I speak having a 30-odd 5 year career in dairy farming, it was, so you're learning something every day. And like the last farm particularly that I was a shift supervisor / manager on was a 3,000 cow farm. And every day was something different. And it was so, they say you need to do something that gets you out of bed every morning. It definitely gets you out of bed every morning. But was something that I just had a passion for it, And I say back in the day when I first started, or when we first moved from Melbourne, all those first experiences on a farm was all about motorbikes, tractors and slug guns. Well, never owned a gun past that slug gun. I hate fixing motors and tractors and small engines, but I've developed this passion for cows and being able to, which have kind of developed from there, but turning green stuff into white stuff, it was a real passion. And I did a talk at the Women in Dairy Conference up at Port Macquarie last year, and I met some young girls that were working on farms, and none of them come from farming backgrounds, but their passion for what they were doing and just learning, because there's so much you can learn, like there's so many skills. And those, agriculture can teach you skills that you can then transport into other parts of your life and then into other careers if agriculture isn't something that isn't lifelong for you. It teaches you so much, and it teaches you independence and like so many skills, resilience and problem solving and all these things that you just don't realize why you're doing it, but at the end of the day when you look back you think, geez, it taught me a lot of stuff that I now use in my everyday life. And it's something like, and ironically my second eldest son who's a cabinet maker for 10 years is now in his second year of his ag degree. He left cabinet making and wanted to be a dairy farmer. I wanted to do an ag degree, so he's doing his ag degree. And my daughter, who's just done year 12, she's now working on a dairy farm as well. It's just there's something about it, dairy farming particularly. There's something about it, and if you're into it, you're into it. But like, I think don't ever be perturbed. It teaches you like work ethic and all these sort of things that. All the good things. It's really hard to put into words, but it's something I encourage anyone to pursue, particularly, if you can get a degree behind you, you can do anything. You can anything from milking cows to being an agribusiness manager at a bank. Getting that education, which, I did have, but I've got 35 years of experience that I can, shared wisdom is that, powerful thing in community. I can share some wisdom that I learned along the way, but I was always learning stuff every day. Like I seen stuff at that big dairy farm that I'd never seen in my whole life, but it was just because it was so big and so, 3,000 cows, you're bound to seeing something different every day. So it was just that dynamic part of being in agriculture. And it's like doing what I do now. It's so interesting to watch, how the team works together, the agronomy team and the harvest team and the field staff, and how we all work together to get a crop into the factory at the end of the year. And there's the trials and tribulations that come along, but agriculture is just a great career to be in. And people ask me that same question or similar question, would you change anything? I'd never change anything, regardless of my journey and it's my person I am today, but I've never changed anything about my agricultural journey. And that's one of the reasons why I could have gone and got a job in a shop or something when COVID hit, but I decided to go back to agriculture because just love it so much.
Yeah, it's definitely a special industry to be part of. And I love that your kids are coming to it as well. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, Warren, thank you so much for joining us and having a chat on the Humans of Ag podcast. I think there's lots of elements of your story, which is pretty confronting, but thank you so much for sharing it. And I think for us, like, we're really passionate about, I guess, healthy people, happy people, healthy and happy communities across rural regional Australia and people more broadly who are involved in agriculture as well. And I think for us, yeah, if anyone is struggling, there is help out there, and whether that's reaching out to a friend and just having a chat, or if you're needing help, likes of Lifeline, 13, 11, 14, TX Foundation. I know those guys are doing incredible work for blue collar workers. There is help out there. And I think, yeah, thank you so much for coming and joining us today and sharing part of your story. And if people want to find out more, they can head over to your website, and hopefully a bunch of our listeners actually get to see you speak at some stage.
Oh, mate, it's been a real privilege. Thank you for having me on. And, you know, you keep up the good work yourself, mate. You're doing a great thing and shining that light on agriculture, which is really important. And particularly, you know, the humans in agriculture, because that's something that sometimes gets overlooked, that, you know, there's really some great people. You know, I'm lucky enough, I get to travel around Australia and meet some great people in rural and, you know, farming communities, and that there's so many good people, so many great stories out there. So keep up the good work yourself, mate. Cheers for having me on.
Well, if you've made it this far, thank you for listening to another episode of the Humans of Agriculture podcast. I think what stood out for me was how in those earlier years, Warren's sense of purpose was really tied to the farm and factors that he didn't actually have control over. If this chat has prompted anything for you or risen anything, please know that there is help. You can reach out to Lifeline on 13 11 14, or our good friends over at Trademut have established the This Is a Conversation Starter helpline, and it is a cracker. So if you need to, reach out. It's 0488 469 88. Look after yourselves, stay safe, stay sane, and we'll chat to you next week.